Our next case this morning is case number 093577, Antonio Jones versus James Basinger. Mr. Nichols, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. In Crawford v. Washington, the Supreme Court held that the Confrontation Clause bars the admission of out-of-court statements against a defendant unless the witness is unavailable and the defendant had a prior opportunity to cross-examine him. Here, the trial court admitted exactly that kind of testimony against my client, Antonio Jones. Two different police officers took the stand to say that somebody told them that somebody else told him the following: that Jones committed the crime, who his accomplices were, what kind of guns were used, where he discarded his weapon, and even why he committed the crime. Now, the state says this incriminating evidence was admissible because it was not offered to show guilt, and because the trial court instructed the jury throughout the taking of the evidence that the testimony was merely to show background. That is not credible for a host of reasons. I'd like to focus on three. First, what the state told the court, trial court that is. Second, the inability of instructions to cure the explosive testimony offered here. And third, the lack of instructions as to one of the two officers. First, the state repeatedly told the judge that the jury cannot be left with the impression that, quote, the only one who puts evidence against Antonio Jones, end quote, is Lenzo Aaron. Lenzo Aaron was the state's star witness, whom the trial judge found lacked credibility. So by the state's own telling, the extensive, inculpatory, third-hand testimony here was offered against Antonio Jones, not merely to show background. And of course, if the state merely wanted to show background, it could have used six simple words: we were acting on a tip. But if the officers had said that, the state's case would have collapsed, because the officers were the pillars of the state's case, which is why the state does not seriously attempt to argue harmless error. Second, no instruction could have fixed the testimony given here. The state put on police officers to say that they heard that third hand that Jones committed the crime, Jones' specific street address, the names of his alleged accomplices, including who would be the one most likely to talk, described the specific caliber of guns used, and even said what Jones's motive was. The second officer also played on the jury's emotions, saying that the witness said he came forward because he was moved by the death of the baby. If these were not powerfully incriminating statements under Bruton v. United States, then nothing is.
Did the third charged accomplice go to trial or also enter into a plea deal with the state? Do you know?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
Third, even if an instruction could have cured this testimony, and we don't believe it could have, no instruction was offered as to the first officer. who testified that the brother of one of the perpetrators told him that Jones committed the crime and where he discarded his weapon.
It's also my understanding that no limiting instruction was given at the in the closing instructions. Is that right?
That's correct.
So the limiting instruction came during the testimony of the second detective, the second case detective?
Correct.
Okay.
Wasn't counsel for Mr. Jones invited to submit some sort of limiting instruction?
Well, he was invited, yes, Your Honor.
But it didn't take up the invitation.
He did. His lawyer waited a few days and thought it over and submitted language to the court asking the court to admonish the jury not to credit the evidence at all.
Well, not limit it, just strike it.
Strike it. That's correct.
That's different than a limitation. That's an exclusion.
It's limiting. but the other thing I would point out is that the state has waived procedural default on this point. The state told the trial judge that an instruction was offered, and they cited the page of the testimony where counsel was objecting to the testimony. The trial judge adopted the state's statement that there was an instruction and put that in the state's in the trial judge's opinion. And so the state, as this court knows, procedural default is an affirmative defense in habeas cases, and procedural default can be waived, and procedural default was waived here. So what we have as to the first officer, as Judge Sykes noted, was no instruction, and the testimony of the first officer, therefore, was a naked confrontation clause violation. This alone requires reversal.
Did you argue the Bruton error in the district court here?
Yes. The memorandum has multiple cites to Bruton. In short, this case presents not one, but two glaring confrontation clause violations under Crawford, and the Indiana Court of Appeals acted unreasonably in concluding otherwise. And for this reason, the writ must be granted. We ask that you reverse the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. Mr. Martin.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the district court because that court correctly determined that the Indiana Court of Appeals had not unreasonably applied Crawford v. Washington here.
The district court didn't talk about Crawford.
Well, I think that the district court did say that the Indiana Court of Appeals had reasonably adjudicated the claim, Your Honor.
In a conclusory way.
And the Indiana Court of Appeals had adjudicated a Crawford claim. We don't take the position that there was no testimonial statement here. There was, of course, but Crawford itself expressly accepts statements that are not used as substantive evidence against the defendant.
What was the legitimate use here?
That's the key to this whole thing, Your Honor. The state was basically accused in opening statement, and this theme persisted throughout the taking of evidence, of fabricating a case against Mr. Jones.
I thought it was simply accused of not having any direct evidence except for Aaron.
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, that kind of charge surely doesn't open the door to otherwise inadmissible evidence, does it?
No, Your Honor, I would say it does not, but it goes farther than that here. One of the statements in opening was, they cannot bring to the table someone who has a whole lot to lose and say, oh, you want me to say he did it? Okay, he did it. Another statement from opening.
Okay, that's an attack on Aaron's credibility.
That doesn't open up the door, does it? The state is content to present that testimony sight unseen in exchange for a deal. Again, they say Aaron told them the man in the moon did it in order to get the deal he got, suggesting that the state was not even concerned with whether there was a web of other evidence that corroborated the case against Mr. Jones. And, in fact, there was, Your Honor. And that evidence came as a follow-up to the tip that they got.
What you have just said is a direct concession of the substantive use of this evidence.
Right. And it's offered not as evidence at all. It was purportedly offered not for the truth of the conflict.
Right. If you used it substantively, this is a good Crawford claim, and the writ have to be granted. And you just conceded that you used it substantively.
I don't understand what it is that you're pointing out that I conceded.
you just admitted to the substantive use of this evidence, this double hearsay.
I'm
as
sorry.
Opposed to its
to
collateral.
Bolster the case against
To strengthen
Jones.
The case as opposed to using it for some collateral admissible purpose.
It was only to show, Your Honor, that the state did not focus its investigation on the witnesses that they did find as a result of Mr. Aaron's information.
Right, but the argument that was being made by the defense in this case was not an attack on the course of the investigation, but attack on the strength of the state's case. In other words, that it rested solely on the testimony of this cooperating co-defendant who was given a sweetheart deal and had all kinds of credibility problems. So the nature of the defense was not an attack on the course of the investigation, but an attack on your star witness. And so you got this evidence in on this collateral argument that wasn't really a collateral argument at all. It was an argument for the admissibility substantively of a co-defendant's statement through two witnesses. Hearsay statement, double hearsay statement.
Well, Your Honor, of course it is double hearsay. Well, the state's position is it's not hearsay because it's not being used.
Well, I understand your position.
For substantive purposes, apparently the court disagrees.
Mr. Martin, let me ask you this. In the examination of, I believe it was Detective Jackson.
Yes.
The state elicited testimony about how pure Mr. Lewis's motives were in making this statement, that he wasn't in it for the money, it was because he was so concerned about the murder of this baby, right?
That is in the record, Your Honor.
That happened. And the state was also allowed to go back and try to, in essence, rehabilitate the accuracy of Lewis's statements to the police officer after the defense counsel had pointed out ways in which his statements had been incorrect, and even allowed the written statement into evidence.
The written statement, I don't believe, was allowed into evidence.
Not the first time it was offered, but the second time after the cross-examination, it was allowed. And I guess my question is, if it wasn't being used for the substantive content to prove the truth, why on earth was Lewis's motive relevant, and why on earth was it appropriate to go back in and try to rehabilitate the credibility of Lewis's statement and to show that he had a pure motive?
Your Honor, if I could first, I respectfully disagree with the court that the written statement was entered. I think that I recall the portion of the record that you're referring to. And the trial court was prepared to allow it in. The state did not wish for that to happen because they wanted to remain consistent with the trial court's initial ruling. If I'm mistaken about that, Your Honor,
I know
I
that
apologize.
Happened, but I believe there was a second round where it did go in. But we'll put that aside. We still have this process of rehabilitation going on, which is difficult to reconcile with not admitting this for the truth of the matters asserted.
And, Your Honor, our position is that that was the result of the manner in which Jones's trial counsel tried the case. Rather than just accepting the admonishment and accepting the statements in the manner in which they were offered for the purpose in which they were offered, trial counsel would then, in cross-examination, go and flesh out a tremendous amount of additional detail.
Well, at that point, what can the defense counsel do? The cat's already out of the bag, and that evidence is in the record in front of the jury. What's the defense counsel going to do? How can it be cabined at that point?
Your Honor, the defense counsel could have just let the statement be as unadorned as it was when initially offered.
Unadorned with all those details about where the gun was disposed of, who had which caliber. I mean, you have a full account of the crime.
Right. Who was doing
what's
the shooting?
What's unadorned about that?
And a warning that there are going to be other witnesses testifying about this, too. It was represented that there will be at least another detective.
Which there were. There was independent evidence of that. And it is the state's position that Mr. Lewis's statements were only related to rebut the implication from defense that this accomplice witness's testimony was accepted sight unseen by the police just in order to close a case. As the jury was appropriately instructed that it couldn't consider this as evidence of guilt.
What's the instruction, the specific passage you're relying on the instruction? Everything I saw was very specific to just one question or two, and it was only for Jackson. Nothing on Davis and nothing in the final instructions.
Your Honor, I believe that there are at least three admonishments during the taking of testimony. And let's see if I can find my notes on that.
We've got it at 1333 and 34. We've got an instruction that is limited to the answer about a question about the timing of a phone call.
I have in my notes at 1334 that they were instructed that they could not consider statements by Mr. Lewis is evidence they could consider in reaching their verdict.
The court said, ladies and gentlemen, the answer to this question is being allowed to show the course of investigation only and is not evidence that you can consider in reaching your verdict. And that's just a question about the timing of the phone call.
Well, Your Honors, I don't have the record before me. My notes don't reflect that particular characterization, but I'll defer to your interpretation.
At 1390, ladies and gentlemen, the answer to that last question is being allowed to show the course of the investigation only and is not evidence that you can consider in reaching your verdict. And that has to do with Hart taking Jones to East Chicago, supposedly to pick up something. Mm. That where actually some restraint was used in how much was said. Mm. And maybe I'm missing something, but those were the limiting instructions that I found.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think there were a couple of others of that character. With regard to whether there would have been final instructions regarding the use of the testimony, the state broached the issue during the discussions about what the instructions should be, and it was never acted upon by trial counsel or the court at trial counsel's behest. I see that my time is up. Respondent would ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you. Mr. Nicholas, you've got 3 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be very brief. The state has, as the court said, conceded the ultimate point. And all along in this case, we have had slips of the tongue, if you will. On page 9 of the Court of Appeals opinion, the Indiana Court of Appeals opinion, that's short appendix 17, the court itself said it was necessary for the state to explain to the jury why the police were investigating Jones, because Jones sought to prove that Aaron, whose credibility was in question, was the only source of evidence against him. So we needed to show this inculpatory evidence so that the jury knew there was other evidence against him. Detailed, specific evidence that the court has just discussed. Second, counsel has said that there were other instructions, and I think I'm with you, Judge Hamilton. I haven't been able to find any other instructions as to Detective Jackson. I think it is that only instruction, and so. Whereas no instructions were offered for Davis, it looks like only one was offered as to a specific question for Jackson. And I think you'll find if you track down, I looked at them last night and I wasn't able to pull the cites as I sat over there, but I think you'll find the other two instructions that the state cites were as to other declarants, not Lewis. And then just the last point, the counsel said there at the end that trial counsel did not ask for an instruction at the end of the case, and what's the answer to that is that she had nearly turned the trial judge against her because she had stood on her head. She filed a written motion to strike. She had this became, in a sense, a mini trial on Crawford, and the record is clear on that. And I think she knew she had already gotten her answer from the trial judge. Unless the court has any further questions, I will simply yield the balance of my time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Mr. Nichols.